Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source, supporting the accountant community. This is Tax Prep Partners to Go, a monthly podcast program with executive editor Darren Root and president and CEO of SurePrep, David Weil, both credentialed CPA CITPs. Listen to Darren and Dave as they explore advanced processes and solutions for tax preparation practices utilizing today's advanced tax document automation technologies.
This is Darren Root, executive editor of CPA Practice Advisor, coming to you with episode 13 of Tax Partner to Go. I'm here again with a guest I've had a number of times in the past, Raj Kapoor. Raj is the Executive Vice President of Center for Project Management. Raj, welcome back again.
Well, hello, Darren. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. And, you know, we've talked, Raj, in the past about just change management in general on some of our podcasts, which, I mean, I find a fascinating topic. You guys still doing a lot of, change management, that area has to continue to grow, doesn't it?
It does. You know, organizations growing, changing, building new markets, deploying new technologies, wherever they're focused, it brings change, and it's an ever-present challenge and a great place to invest time and energy to help ensure that, you know, the investments pay off. So very busy area, absolutely.
Yeah, as you and I have talked in the past, you know, a lot of organizations, especially accounting firms, you know, really come at this from the standpoint that, you know, they're just going to take often their novice approach to implementing change in their firms, and it oftentimes doesn't go all that well. And there's a whole behavior science around this idea of change management, right?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's interesting. There's, just as you said, there's a science to it, but actually we think of it as an art as well, because so much of change management is about winning and keeping the hearts and minds of the team on the task at hand, the initiative that we're focused on. So there's some methodology there. There's some leadership there. There's a lot of ingredients that come together to ensure change is successfully ushered through the business.
Well, I think today you're going to introduce me to a new topic, a new title, and I'm pretty excited to talk through this with you. But today we're going to talk about something you call intelligent disobedience. Start out by just telling me and our listeners what that means.
Sure. Well, great. And I'm excited to talk about this as well, because intelligent disobedience is a concept that we actually came across many years ago in a very different paradigm. We actually connected with an organization that's in the business of developing and graduating guide dogs for the blind. And this concept, this behavior actually, this behavior set of intelligent disobedience is something that guide dogs, service dogs, must be able to demonstrate before they can graduate into, you know, being of service to their handlers. And I'll tell you more about that in a moment, but what's just fascinating to us is we found that this same behavior set, this same approach, perspective, a number of things, is such a valuable and an important set of behaviors for organizations to both enable and to practice. So we'll explore that. But just to get started, So what happens is a guide dog is, especially for a non-sighted person, is responsible, of course, for keeping the owner out of harm's way. And I'll just give you a quick scenario to illustrate this. Imagine that a non-sighted person is at a crosswalk and they have their dog on, you know, the special handle that they, the harness that they have them. And the dog is trained that when the traffic stops and the tone sounds for the crosswalk, which signifies the crosswalk is clear, the tone sounds, and then the handler gives a tug on the handle for the dog, those two conditions, once those are met, the dog is to proceed, of course, across the crosswalk. Well, intelligent disobedience is practiced when, in that scenario, someone is running a red light, for example, and the dog, even though it has received its double command, proactively keeps its owner, its handler, out of harm's way by intelligently disobeying that command because it sees the obstruction, it sees the dangerous situation developing. Well, if we take that concept and we think about how valuable and effective that can be in an organizational setting and where we empower and enable our teams, our managers, to practice this, in other words, leadership has to allow it, then we are going to proactively make better decisions, select better projects, help usher change through the business more effectively. And this is, in a nutshell, this is what intelligent disobedience is all about.
You know, I guess as somebody who owns a business, my first thought is, well, I would have to really sit down and empower my staff to have that skill, because they're not going to, not everybody is going to naturally have that. They're going to think, wow, he's the boss, I'm not going to say anything, right?
Absolutely correct. And this is the interesting thing, because when we think about bringing change into the organization, it creates fear, it creates uncertainty. And so if a team feels empowered, feels supported in bringing their best ideas, recommendations, what they see in the environment, and bringing it to the attention to leadership, creating visibility for it, without the often concern of being persecuted or penalized for delivering bad news, this is an issue. And so you're absolutely correct, and this is what we see. Leaders have to get it and understand that I need to put my people in a position to practice this, to feel safe and supported. And managers, team members, the staff needs to also understand how to do this and how to practice this, because telling me, hey, I can do something new, and being able to do it are two different things. And so there's a bit of skill and process. There's a bit of leadership, as we said, and a lot of ingredients, again, that come together to create what we think of as a more progressive and mature business environment. And this is where we all want to live. This is what we all want to, you know, be a part of professionally.
Well, that actually makes really good sense to me. You know, it seems to me like, as I've talked to you before, there's three pieces to your center's intelligent disobedience methodology. Can you talk through really those three different pieces?
Absolutely. It's broken into, first, defining the opportunity. So that could be a change, a new project, whatever new potential, new situation has come into the thinking and understanding of leadership. You know, should we do it? What is it? The sort of thing. So defining the new opportunity is first. Second is using what's known as Socratic dialogue, a way of exploring and pushing on this new opportunity in a number of ways, using thoughtful, very important questions that help to validate just how effective, how viable this new opportunity is for the organization. And lastly, to from there, think creatively as to how we're going to take advantage of this if the new idea, the new opportunity really passes the test. So in essence, this is about filtering ideas through a very thoughtful process, a collaborative process, to ensure that we're making the best choices. Because, you know, there's a term that we like to call management by magazine. And as a matter of fact, we can use a three-letter acronym, MBM, because, of course, this wouldn't be an official management talk if we didn't come up with some new acronyms, right?
Sure.
So management by magazine is, you know, this idea of, hey, you know what? I just read in such and such that someone is doing thus and so, and why aren't we doing that, right? And knee-jerk reaction, all excited, new technology, new process, new something or other, and all of a sudden we find ourselves applying resources, people, time to this idea. Now, the thing is, if we do that too much, too often, and spread ourselves thin, then we don't take true advantage of these opportunities, and we may invest in opportunities that we think of. We have a term called half-baked ideas. And we don't want to spend time on half-baked ideas because they're just that. They're half-baked. They're not necessarily viable. And by using this process, we tend to focus ourselves on the best activities, the best new opportunities that'll bring positive change into the business.
So as you talked about the three pieces, I understood the concept of defining the business opportunity. And I believe I understand the concept of thinking creatively. But you said use Socratic dialogue. Talk to me a little, or me and the audience, a little bit more about what that really means and how we can create that framework, that dialogue.
Great, absolutely. And just to touch on, to your point, and I agree, you know, defining the opportunity is a straightforward activity. As a matter of fact, in some of our previous discussions around change management, we actually introduced to the audience some great tools around defining what are your critical success indicators, how do you specifically measure the success of this new opportunity. And so just to bring that forward, I think it's a really good place to begin. So first, certainly define your target in a very clear sense. And then this whole notion of Socratic dialogue, there are 9 key questions that we find to be an effective, together, a filter to use in this process. And I'll just briefly walk you through those and we can talk about them. Number one, which strategy objective is this idea that we're considering linked to? So this whole idea of alignment is important. We don't want to invest in effort and activities that don't align with where we're going organizationally. So if strategy is well stated and defined, then any new opportunity, large or small, should have some alignment at some level with that future vision, that future state that we're trying to strategically get to. The second question, is there buy-in? So across the leadership, whether it's a very small firm, a large firm, whatever the case, the leadership must be together bought in to the opportunity. And there are some important ways to certainly look through that and consider that buy-in. So for example, are the people who have authority bought into it? Because if I'm a junior manager and I'm excited about something, well, that's not enough. I mean, I've got to have leadership who's going to fund it, support it, oversee it, bought in. Do we have organizationally the right skills and experience to take advantage of this? Can we be bought into something that is completely foreign and unfamiliar to us? This is a risk area, so we want to consider how well aligned are we and can we buy into this? And then commitment and responsibility. These are two other aspects of being bought in that are important. Yes, I'm excited about it, but what are my responsibilities as a leader or as a manager, whatever role I play? So I really want to line my team up against this new opportunity and figure out how we're going to move it forward.
Sure.
The next question, who will sponsor the project, is a very important question. So that is, again, that leader who is going to have the skin in the game to move this new idea that has met the business high-level filter, you know, critical success indicators and so on, and will then usher and shepherd this through to its completion. So these are first of the three questions that we touch on, and there are a number of others. Any first thoughts or reactions to those thus far?
Absolutely. I think who will sponsor the project? I mean, you and I have talked on a couple other podcasts about that idea. That seems to me like that stems from, you know, what a lot of people in the profession like to call product champions or whatever that might be, project champions. Somebody is, are we talking about the same thing there? Or is a sponsor a different person?
Yeah, sure. Sponsorship in the classic sense, from a project perspective, we tend to define as the first of all, it's an individual. So for example, in a partnership model, we have a number of peer level leaders who have tremendous political, financial, and other power and decision capability in the organization. What we need to do is define a single person who is the voice of that leadership group, who will provide the oversight, the vision, the political sort of protection, if you will, for the project and the project manager as I move through the project as the PM responsible for getting the work done. There might be pushback here and there, which is beyond and above my ability to manage. And that sponsor needs to provide that cover and that protection and support for me if I'm that PM. So they own the budget, they own the scope, and they provide ongoing, consistent support to the PM who's again, at that execution level of getting the work done. These are some of the key sort of profile elements of what we think of as the sponsor.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. All right, I get that so far.
Yeah, so going forward, another key question is, what is the value to the business? So in the first sort of filtering process, we said, okay, basic business case, looks like a good idea, but now we need to really ensure we understand in a tangible fashion, once in operation, once this new software, this new hardware, this business process change, whatever we're going to invest in is made, how is that going to benefit us? Because there are targets we define in terms of budget, in terms of schedule to get the work done. But now, once in operation, what kind of return do we expect on this investment? So we want to, again, that's a key question that must be answered before we sign our name to committing our capital, whether they be human resources, money, and time. So this is key. Number five, how will we know that it is a success? So this is interesting from a change management perspective as well. When I start to reach out and ask different key stakeholders in an organization what their vision of success is for a new initiative, sometimes you get different answers. And this can be a risk to the change process and also to the success of the project. Again, in a partner environment, that's especially important because we have a lot of key players who have great visibility and investment in these activities. So we want to have alignment and closure on that. And this Socratic dialogue brings us together, has that conversation facilitated amongst the team. So again, we're ensuring alignment. So we're just continuing to push on this and kind of poke at it, if you will, in a thoughtful, helpful way to make sure that there's no sort of stragglers, differences, key differences of opinion and so on that can serve to undermine us potentially as we move forward. Because in the absence of that clarity, again, it can create risk. So these are a couple of other key points. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, again, you know, a lot of these, or a few of these, maybe not a lot of them, but a few of these go back to some of the change management stuff we've talked about in the past. I mean, having that measurement of success and knowing that you've reached it and those benchmarks seems like it would be critically important.
Absolutely, and this idea of intelligent disobedience is a style of bringing this dialogue to the environment, because while, let's say, there's two partners in an organization and they have a staff of 15 or 20, what we're suggesting here is that broader staff have a seat at the table and have an opportunity to ask and answer these questions on behalf of the organization and on their own behalf, so that leadership has a broader, more holistic view of how the organization sort of thinks, believes, expects things to move forward. Because sometimes, again, leadership in some environments can tend to be a bit disconnected from the rest of the group. And this process of allowing intelligent disobedience, which in this particular line of discussion, we're not disobeying here. What we're saying is, tell me more about this. This is what I think. Are we all aligned? And that healthy dialogue, sometimes, you know, in a more traditional environment, a hierarchical environment, isn't supported. And so we want to usher that in, push a little bit on the culture, if you will, to get a healthier exchange of ideas and discussions going.
Yeah, a lot of the small firms I see operate, and we try to help a lot of firms with, you know, implementation of new technologies and things like that. But what I see is it's either a very top-down, the owner or the partners decide this is what we're going to do, and they implement it, and they just tell everybody this is what we did. Or they're very hands-off, and they just said, here, office manager, or here, staff person, go do this and just get it done. And neither one seems to work overly well. And
I think those traditional – pardon me.
No, that's all right. But I listen to you on even the key questions they asked so far, none of those questions have been asked in either one of those scenarios that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And just to restate, it's by asking and answering these questions, we certainly, I think, have in our experience, a higher quality, more informed decision will tend to be made in that moment. But there's also some other tremendous benefits to this, which is beyond the question or the investment at hand. It's about team dynamics. It's about leadership. It's about, you know, when we open up the Wall Street Journal or Fortune magazine or any number of, you know, news business resources we might enjoy and tend to find ourselves looking at, invariably you hear about the top places to work, you know, best places to work. And in my experience, large or small, one of the things that define the quote-unquote best places to work is that everyone has a voice.
Yeah.
Everyone has an opportunity to contribute, to discuss. I think, you know, it's interesting, my first background, I'm formally educated in psychology. And there's an innate, you know, I love the introspective piece of leadership and trying to understand how and why people connect and communicate and so on as they do. And we all, as human beings, have an innate need to be heard. Whether the final decision is going to go our way or not, if I'm able to share my perspective, to say my piece, if you will, then I feel, and I am, more valued, more respected in the organization, and I feel much closer and part of the team. So I think, again, part of the value of introducing and supporting a methodological sort of approach to communicating and moving through new ideas, this intelligent disobedience methodology, it creates also this, again, a more progressive, mature environment where we can thoughtfully share and agree that we may not all agree on things. That's okay, but we want to be informed, and that's the goal, an informed decision. So some other thoughts on this that I think are important for our listeners to consider and to, you know, support the idea of allowing some of these new approaches, if they're new, into their environment.
Sure. Well, we've talked through five of, I believe, your nine key questions. So let's talk through the remaining four.
Sure. The next is a more tactical question, which is who will use the end product? Whether we're, again, bringing in new technologies, changing business processes, whatever the product of this project, this new opportunity may be, who exactly is going to use it? Because we want to ask questions under this area, such as what might be the expected disruptions to the routine operations of the business? Because any change creates some disruption. We want it to be productive, of course, but there's going to be something displaced, and so let's understand that in a very tactical sense. And directly to the change question, what's the degree of change that this is going to bring? When should we do this? Because, of course, in the accounting environment, it's a very seasonal business, and so we want to choreograph key sorts of changes, especially if they may be quite expensive or fundamental to how we do business, moving from a manual to an automated environment, for example, deploying new technologies, for example, that underlie our basic business processes. Of course, timing is a key factor. And as leaders, we want to also take a temperature of our organization and of ourselves, frankly. What's our willingness to absorb these changes? Because it looks good on paper, but emotionally, you know, as an individual, again, as a team, how ready are we? What's our ability to absorb change? And I think this is a key piece of this as well, as we consider who will use the end product and again, how is it going to affect them?
Okay.
The next question is, how realistic are the assumptions that we're making? So this is sort of looking back and checking ourselves as a team and saying, you know, we're going in and making some key assumptions around what it's going to cost us, how long it's going to take, how we're defining the quality that we expect. and things of this nature. And are those, can we validate those assumptions? Because those are certainly underlying the decision as well. Because, you know, if you tell me it's going to cost $10,000, okay. If it ends up costing us $100,000, not okay. So we have to be confident in these underlying, you know, assumptions. And this takes us back again to some of our previous discussions around taking a project approach to bringing in new opportunities, changes to the organization, because a good project approach will have us move through an effective planning and estimating process, as opposed to, again, back to our MBM, you know, Management by Magazine, where we get excited about something and we just leap to getting to work on it and making it happen. Sometimes I see the word, that's entrepreneurial, right? And entrepreneurial is great, but it needs to be balanced with some good process. So this is
absolutely,
these are some thoughts on that one. Yeah. So any thoughts on or reactions to these two pieces?
You know, the realistic assumption I find interesting because I just think of the whole healthcare debate. I mean, that whole legislation is based on a certain set of assumptions. And, you know, assuming those assumptions go well or are accurate or fairly accurate, everything may go well. But if they're not, then, you know, we have a whole different scenario. So I can really see where really going back and listing, because most times, like you talk about the MBM, Management by Magazine, you know, there's probably no assumptions even set up front if you just start into a project. So I'm, you know, the whole idea of just creating assumptions as to what I'm, we put new servers in last week, Raj, in our office, and I'm in my mind going through this dialogue that we're having, thinking, wow, there's a whole bunch of these things that I wish we'd have had this conversation a week ago, because I would have thought a little differently about that and probably helped myself in some of the process.
Sure. So. Well, and I appreciate that. And to the healthcare example, I think this also illustrates another very important piece to this, which is the assumptions, you know, because the healthcare process is certainly, it's a slow boat to turn, you know, because it's such a huge thing and it takes so long for something of that nature to actually move in a different direction. And when we make a first set of assumptions at a certain point in time, well, it's very important in a disciplined fashion to revisit those assumptions, because just by the passage of time, so many things can change.
Sure.
And whether it's something as large as that or something like your server project example, installation example, you know, the rate of change, just time passing and the price of materials, the availability, any number of factors. You know, so it's always a good practice to just consistently revisit this in a discipline. And that's really a discipline discussion more than anything. It's not complicated to do, but it's a proactive thing to do, a progressively sort of mature, you know, again, sort of reflection of an environment where we're saying, okay, here's what we think, right? Because assumptions are what we think, not what we know. And do we still think that? are the underlying factors remaining the same? So good stuff to consider and to revisit. The last two questions, number 8, is there institutional memory? So what I'm saying here is, have we ever done this before? Because if we have, let's not reinvent the wheel, right? Let's not rediscover for the first time, actually, a number of things we know, we can expect, we can see. Because just tied back to the assumptions discussion, I would love if 3 years ago we installed servers into the organization or we made a change in some area of our business, while it was 3 years ago, some of the due diligence, some of the process that we go through, They're timeless. They're universal, right? The good process. And I always like to benefit from my experience, others' experience, if I can get my hands on that. Always a good thing. And to that end, also, what are the risks? Because if we thought about and considered some key risks, maybe we don't look at those as closely this time, and I want to benefit always from that background. And lastly, when it comes to this idea of institutional memory, if things didn't go very well last time, let's be honest about it, right? Let's not estimate, you know, there's a phrase we call estimating to please. You know, I work for you and you say, Raj, how long is it going to take you to do that? And I tell you a number, not based on so much the nature of the work, but what I know you want to hear. And this is a very common practice and an understandable one because we want to make our leaders happy. But in an environment where intelligent disobedience is supported, bad news or news that's contrary to what we would like is supported because it's reality. And let's work with what we're really facing as a group, as opposed to some degree, maybe setting aside, if not burying, what we know to also be true and hoping for the best. Because when we have a line, we always say, yeah, all things can be known, right? The question is, when will you know them?
So as I think about this institutional memory component, you know, it seems like, and I'm going to use my server example, I should document my process a bit, what went well, what may not have gone so well, what did I learn, what would I do differently, things like that, so that I'm not challenged 3 years from now with going through the same challenges that we might have gone through this time.
Absolutely. And that's a very well said. We think of that, and I think you said it well, a continuous improvement, right? Investing in understanding not just what we accomplished, but how we got there, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, all things tend to get done, but the question is at what cost? And if it cost us too much money or too much time or unnecessary stress or risk, you know, let's benefit from that, as we talked about, and bring that experience forward. So very good thing to spend a little time on at the end of each project and really look back and have a true sense of what happened. And to find, you know, sort of round out our 9 questions, and I think, you know, it's interesting. I think this is the most important one. The question is, what are the implications of doing nothing? Because fundamentally, if you ask that question and we honestly answer it as an organization, it will tend to filter out emotionally charged ideas, wants, wishes, right? Ideals, things that are very strong, that tend to drive and create a lot of passion and interest, but not necessarily the best for the business. You know, I love iPhones, but my entire team uses Android phones. We should migrate to iPhones, right? Okay, why? Well, because it has this feature and it has that feature and all this, you know, great new technologies, better interfaces. What's the implication of doing nothing? We have phones that work just fine, right? That have more than enough capability, and we've got 4 other ideas that will actually address our profitability, could drive better efficiency into our business. Let's refocus on those things that are not nice to have, but are really must have. And this question of what are the implications of actually not going forward is a very good disciplined question to ask.
You know, Raj, one of the things that strikes me here, and because you mentioned the iPhone example, and let's assume for a moment that you're correct, that the implications of moving forward, of doing nothing, is not negative. You still have phones, albeit droids, and so on and so forth. But there's an emotional component to that. From me as a business person, I just like the latest technology, I like the mobile device, or I like the iPhone, whatever it is.
Sure.
How do you temper that, you know, these small entrepreneurs, small firm owners, you know, oftentimes they get caught up in an emotional decision. How do you temper that?
Sure. Well, great question. And it takes us back to some of the points that we touched on a few moments ago. What's the value to the business? How do you define success for this? Who will use it? By thinking about and quantifying the impact to the organization in a fashion that is beyond emotion, but rather in dollars, in efficiency, in the factors that we measure, right, and use to survive in tough times and to grow in better times. these are the filters, the variables, I should say, that need to be considered to temper the emotion. Because, you know, I'll tell you, I love iPhones. I mean, just for the heck of that example, I love all kinds of new things and great things. But the question is, how is that going to help my business? And is it the best investment right now?
Sure.
You know, that's the thing. Is it the best investment right now? And so to temper this and to go from a subject, the idea, in my view, is to, if we think of the spectrum of a subjectively driven emotional decision to an objectively driven, data-driven decision, the truth is the decisions that are made tend to fall in the middle and are guided by both sides of that. But I want to be leaning a little more on the objective side so that the data supports how I feel.
Sure.
The data tells the story. This process facilitates us in not ignoring the data and actually diving into it and pushing us to perform a little discipline around gathering that so that we make, because we're all going to make the decisions, we just want to make more informed decisions. And that's the goal.
So if I go back in and I reframe our discussion again, the disobedience, the intelligent disobedience methodology, you mentioned we first need to define the business opportunity, and we said that makes sense. Use the Socratic dialogue, which is the nine items that we just talked through. And then lastly, think creatively.
Exactly.
And so in wrapping that up with think creatively, is that where your team sort of comes together to formalize their thinking?
Yes, and what I'm looking for here is a rational exchange of good ideas, empowering everyone to be a part of that. Because a group creative process around a new opportunity that's been vetted and validated to some degree is a very exciting and interesting place to be. And you want to create an environment where, again, just that, everybody with the benefit of that due diligence that we've just gone through, defining the business value and the other, you know, answers that we now have to our questions, with all of that framed, now let's come together and let's think about how we can leverage this new situation with creative, you know, and we all say out of the box, you know, this is the place to be, out of the box. And focus, because what we've done is we've narrowed our focus. And with half-baked ideas sort of bouncing around the organization, it creates some, you know, we call it MAD, Management Attention Deficit Disorder. You know, we're all kind of focused and looking at so many different possibilities that the creative energy is just spread too thin. So by getting rid of that clutter, getting rid of the noise and focusing and narrowing, we can bring the creative energy of the team onto that one opportunity and go after it. And so this is what I'm looking for there.
This reminds me a bit of, I helped facilitate the Seven Habits from Stephen Covey for a number of years. And, you know, one of his habits is the concept of synergize, right? And, you know, the synergize idea is, it's not necessarily my idea or your idea that's the best idea. It's the sum of the one plus one, Covey always says, you know, equals three in this situation, because you come out with a significantly better solution if you sit down. And what I'm framing in my mind, if I go through this process with my team or the key people in my organization, I'm going to get a better solution than either one of us would have come up with by ourselves.
Exactly. Well said. And, you know, Covey, a guru in this area, absolutely on the same, you know, along the same lines here. This is a great way to bring that, again, together to your team. And it's, and you know, it's just incredibly empowering to be a team member in an organization and to have a seat at that table, having been a part of vetting and defining and filtering new opportunities and coming together and saying, you know what, this is something we really want to spend time on, so let's figure out how to make it work as a group. I mean, that's a great place to be, you know, a part of. And this, these are the organizations that I think tend to win and consistently win.
Absolutely.
It's exciting.
Well, Raj, we're out of time today. I really appreciate, as always, talking to you and learning so much from all you guys do at the center. So thanks for your time today, and hope you have a great holiday season.
Aaron, thank you so much. Great to be with you again. Happy holidays to your family, and looking forward to the next time we collaborate.
Great. Thanks, Raj. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106, or tune in to future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via TalkShoe.com.